Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Lee Fulkerson, a series of podcasts from Plant Pure Nation. I'm Lee Fulkerson, and my guest today is Dr. Pam Popper. Dr. Popper is a naturopath, nutritionist, and the executive director of the Wellness Forum Health, which offers educational programs to both consumers and providers that facilitate informed medical decision-making, diet and lifestyle intervention, and improved long-term health outcomes. Dr. Popper serves on the Physicians Steering Committee and the President's Board for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in Washington, D.C. She was also one of the healthcare professionals involved in the famed Sacramento Food Bank Project. She has appeared in numerous documentaries, including Forks Over Knives, and is a New York Times bestselling author. Her most recent book is Food Over Medicine. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Well, thank you for having me. Looking forward to it.
Great. Okay, so to get off the button here, what exactly is a naturopath and how does it differ from being an MD?
Well, it doesn't differ as much as you might imagine. The classical naturopaths, which I'm one of those, are trained in non-toxic, non-invasive therapies that either maintain health or can resolve disease. So just a couple of examples, an arthritic patient goes to a medical doctor and says, gosh, I have a lot of pain, and the medical doctor prescribes a COX-2 inhibitor. That same person visits a naturopath who might talk a little bit about diet but prescribe a supplement like glucosamine. And so the similarities, as you can see, are symptomatic treatment with maybe less toxic stuff, but still approaching it from a symptom standpoint rather than underlying cause. So differences in terms of the strategies that are used in some respects, but similarities in that I think all branches of medicine sometimes avoid what we should be paying attention to is the underlying cause of the condition and starting there. And so that's how I'm a little bit different from some of my colleagues.
Okay, so are there any other strengths of being a naturopath as opposed to being an MD?
Well, I think from the standpoint of focusing on first do no harm, we're maybe a little more conscious of that. But I frankly, you know, I find myself in the unusual position of being critical of my own colleagues, and some of them are sometimes pretty upset with me, but I tell people I'm an equal opportunity critic because what we should be doing is following the evidence. And so to a certain extent, some in the naturopathic or alternative field are maybe even a little more quickly ready to jump off the cliff and do things without a lot of supporting evidence, even more so than the medical field. So there are a lot of parallels, and I think that as I look at medicine, and I know what we're trying to resolve here and what I try to address in my own practice is let's look at, first of all, what is the cause of disease, and then let's take a really critical look at evidence to support the things that we recommend to patients. And when there isn't any evidence, we should not go there.
Mm-hmm. All right. So when and why did you get interested in becoming a naturopath?
I got interested in diet first. I mean, I wasn't even thinking about credentialing and education and all this sort of thing. I mean, I was a person who spent the first 20 years of my life eating, drinking, and being merry. I mean, I just never gave any of this any thought. And my diet was terrible. I didn't exercise. So I'm only half kidding when I say I used to put my garbage cans on the hood of the trunk, the hood of the car, and drive them to the street because I didn't want to move, you know. And so I was a pretty unlikely candidate to be interested in any of this. So it all started for me with reading a book about diet written by John McDougall. You know John. And made a profound impression on me. I mean, I never thought about this stuff before. I decided that the first thing I needed to do was to clean up my own act, and it wasn't until considerably later that I decided that I was going to pursue some education. And I knew I was never going to want to prescribe drugs and perform surgery and that sort of thing, so naturopathy was maybe a little closer to what I thought my scope of practice was going to be. So it was maybe more of a default decision than, gosh, I just really want to learn what naturopaths learn and know about. So that's how I became a naturopath. And I had to, you know, you hear a lot of people in this field, in the medical field, saying that they've had to learn new things to embrace this idea that diet has such a profound influence on health and it's where we should be focusing. I had to do just as much unlearning and relearning as any medical doctor has had to do to get interested in this stuff.
So when and why did you adopt a plant-based diet?
Because I was a garbage eater. ago, and I looked at myself. I mean, I was, well, not quite 25 years, but I was overweight. I mean, here I was in, you know, almost 40 years old, and I was overweight, and I looked awful. I mean, I look back. The pictures of me when I was 38, I'm almost 60 now. I look younger now than I did then. I'm leaner now.
I can't believe you're 60.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm fighting, kicking, and screaming, you know, this aging thing. I'm not going to let it happen to me. But I took I took stock of myself, and I just wasn't taking care of myself. It wasn't part of my value system. It was a big wake-up call for me. And I, all of a sudden, I became really interested in health. And I looked at my family history. I lost my mom 3 years ago, and she spent 20 years of her life sick. And I watched that happen to my grandmother. And I thought, I don't want this. You know, I want something else. I want health. And it was clear to me. The evidence was really clear. As you know, John McDougall supports what he says with studies and research. And I was convinced I needed to change my ways. And I did. And I didn't do it right in the beginning. I, like a lot of people, did the junk food vegetarian thing and all that. But once I got it right and I started exercising, it almost became addictive. It's like I want more health. The more health I got, the more health I wanted.
That's great. So there was no particular aha moment. Was the aha moment reading Dr. McDougall's book?
Yeah, and I was lucky because I wasn't sick. You know, so many people, this is where I look at my life, and I have been one of the most blessed individuals that you'll ever meet, because so many people come to this way of living and thinking about health because of a crisis. They have cancer.
Exactly.
They have heart disease.
Yes.
They had a heart attack. Something terrible happened. I didn't have anything terrible happen. I was fat and tired and didn't take care of myself, and that's easy enough to fix.
Well, that's good. But you do hear that a lot, and I hear it a lot too, interviewing people and providers too. That, you know, it's the sick people that are the easy ones to get. It's the younger people that are healthy that are harder to talk to.
Well, they think they're impervious. I mean, they really think that they're going to live forever, and that what we're talking about, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, isn't going to happen to them. And I think to an extent we have to talk to them a little bit differently about things that do interest them. They're interested in their appearance. They're interested in performance at work. They're interested in athleticism. All of those things, by the way, are affected by diet. They're also interested in the environment. They're interested in making the world a better place. And so you talk to a 25-year-old just slightly differently than you're going to talk to somebody who's in our generation.
Yeah, I agree. I think that seems to be the dichotomy that I notice, is that the younger demographic, you want to stress environment, maybe animal rights and things like that. And you know, with the older folks who are starting to suffer from some of these chronic conditions, then the health has a really strong impact.
You know what, though, and I'll tell you, this is scary, but younger and younger people are getting more and more serious things, and it's even extending into childhood. One of the most horrifying things I read, and this was 2 or 3 years ago, was a statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics that we need to start testing cholesterol in grade school children. And and the advice was, if kids can't get their cholesterol down with diet and lifestyle changes, then you prescribe a statin drug. And there's a chewable version of Lipitor. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, Jesus, that's terrifying.
It is terrifying. The thought of giving a third grader a chewable Lipitor because his cholesterol is high, I mean, that should be a wake-up call for all of us. Something is terribly wrong.
Right next to their Flintstones vitamin, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, they,
well, only to be exceeded by. I read this in a cardiology journal one day, and I had to show it to somebody else in the office just to make sure I wasn't crazy. You know, you can't believe what you're seeing. And it was an article suggesting, it was written by some cardiologist and published in a pretty respectable journal, suggesting that now that some of these statin drugs are available over the counter, maybe we could put them at the condiment stand of fast food restaurants so you could get get your ketchup, get your statin drug. I mean, it's such a ludicrous idea. And then you know how online they have these, you can make comments, and so everybody starts commenting. Yeah. And this one doctor comments that, well, you know, it's sort of like we fortify all these grain products with folic acid. That would be sort of similar. You just make the statin drugs available. Everybody goes to fast food restaurants. And I thought, oh, my gosh. I mean, this is about as bad. Every time I think it's as bad as it can get, then there's some other thing that happens, and it's like, oh, my gosh, we've sunk to it. Even
they'll make it part.
Now.
Next, yeah, no, they'll make it part of the Happy Meal.
Yeah,
or something
that's it. We
like
start
that,
them early as a preventive thing. We'll put statin drugs in their Happy Meals.
And of course, I've heard stories too about people wanting to put statins in the water supply.
Oh yeah, a serious discussion about it. It is. I mean, this isn't a Saturday Night Live skit. This is actually serious cardiologists on Medscape saying that we should think about this.
Well, thank God we're not to that point yet.
Not yet. So, we have a lot of work to do.
We do. So now let's switch gears a little. When and why did you found the Wellness Forum Health? I'm very interested in that.
Well, we started out as Wellness Forum, and then we converted to a healthcare system about 3 years ago. But that was kind of an accidental thing. You might think, well, gosh, this woman's whole life is an accident. but, you know, they say that man plans, God laughs, and life is what happens while you're making plans to do something else. But basically, when I started changing my life around, it made a big difference. My appearance changed. My attitude changed. I looked better, felt better. It was obvious. And then I eventually went back to school, and people were interested in what I was saying about these things. And I was busy at the time, so I organized a little class in my house. And I had 12 people come. It was on September 16th of 1996. This is our 20th anniversary this year, actually.
Oh, wow.
And so I organized this little class, and some people came, and I didn't have any textbooks or anything formal. I just was, here's some basic principles of eating, and they brought friends, and it just sort of took off from there. And my neighbors decided that maybe I should find another place to do this because I had all this traffic coming and going. So I rented a little place around the corner from my house, and I thought, well, if I'm going to pay rent, I think I have to charge people. I hope they don't all leave, and they didn't. But I think what motivated me to do it was that I did it all wrong. I didn't have anybody to show me anything. So I mentioned I'd done the junk food version of this, and I remember, I was telling everybody loves this vegan food. You know, we're eating vegan Oreos and vegan chicken nuggets. And, of course, I think I gained 10 pounds, right? It was getting worse instead of better. And I finally figured out the whole food thing. But there was nobody to show me what to do, and people clearly needed that direction. So that's how I started. And then as time went on, I added a lot of services. I guess I just started paying attention to what people needed. And so many people take psych drugs, and so many people have knee injuries, and so many people want food delivered to their house. And just eventually we grew this company to provide all kinds of services, and now we even own our own school. We'll be a university in 3 years. That's kind of
exciting. Oh, my God.
I know.
It's incredible.
I'm really proud of what we've done here, you know. So.
No, you should be.
Yeah.
So what are the mission goals of Wellness Forum?
Well, here's what I would like to see happen. I think healthcare is really precarious now. I liken it. This is the analogy I use in my talks. You know, if you think back to the automobile industry a few decades ago, you know, three big car makers in Detroit, and they were selling cars that weren't really so good, and they were really ridiculously expensive, and it took 17 people at General Motors to sign off on changing the paint color on a car. It was very inefficient situation, not consumer-oriented at all. And the silly thing about it was these car makers in Detroit actually thought that for the rest of their days they would rule the car market. And like little stealth invaders, the foreign car makers came in here, they decimated the market because consumers were unhappy and looking for an alternative. And that's basically what we're doing. This idea, we've carved out this little niche for ourselves. It's called informed medical decision making. It means that you look at the risks and benefits of anything that you're thinking of doing before you do it, and then you inform, we change the informed consent. Usually informed consent, a doctor or health professional tells you to do something, that's called informing, and you say, okay, that's called consenting. In our model of healthcare, you come here, you learn all about your options, and then you go back and inform your healthcare providers of what you intend to do. while that's going on, we're building our own healthcare network. So eventually, this will be the place. We'll be like the foreign car makers. You can come over here, and all of the providers will be here. It's kind of an elaborate thing to explain in a situation like this, but eventually, it'll be an alternative healthcare system, so you can actually drop out of the old one and come here, and our providers provide things.
What a great idea, and that's a model, I think, for the future of how to deliver healthcare in a smart way, in an effective way.
Well, and here's the problem, Lee. We can all agree it's a great idea, but the healthcare system can't do this on its own, and I'll tell you why. Because this very interesting thing happens when people start getting information. It drives up their enthusiasm for a lot of medical treatment. And so if a healthcare delivery system decided to adopt this and said, you know, that Pam Popper, she's kind of smart, she figured this out, but we have so much money, we'll do this and we can do it better than her, and with their money they actually could. The problem is they go into a state of self-liquidation. You know, think about it, if the Cleveland Clinic sent everybody to Dr. Esselstyn, there would be there would be so little bypass surgery, they'd have to close
the entire
business.
Yeah, they'd be out of business.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's the whole, I mean, it's almost like it's you're designing a healthcare system to put healthcare systems out of business, or at least traditional ones.
Exactly, exactly. We still need healthcare. You know, sometimes people will say, oh, you're anti-doctor, you're anti-drug. I'm not anti-anything. I'm pro-evidence. Here's what is a big problem in healthcare, is that there is a usefulness for almost everything. I can think of maybe a dozen things that we should just stop entirely. But almost everything else, there is a population for which it is useful. The problem is you can't make a lot of money if you only offer the service to that group. So what you do if you're enterprising is you figure out how to make it attractive to everybody. So instead of doing 15,000 bypass surgeries a year in this country, we do 500,000. Instead of 15,000 angioplasties, we do 500,000. Instead of using mammography as a diagnostic tool, we screen all women. You know, so it's that trying to mass market these things that creates the problem. And so when people start to understand, this is where the informed decision making comes in. Am I really a candidate for this? Am I going to benefit from this? The answer is most people say no.
So what is your role at the Wellness Forum, Hal?
Oh, well, my role is to, I used to be the chief content creator, but now we have other partners who do a lot of that too. My goal is to just guide the organization. I have a lot of great business partners and a building full of people who work really hard at this and are incredibly talented at what they do. I'm just the force that sort of holds it together and keeps the ship going in the right direction. And because of my experience in this business, and thanks to a lot of the publicity that I got from Forks Over Knives and that sort of thing, I can go out. I'm contacted by a lot of physicians and healthcare providers who are looking for alternatives, and so I can recruit them to be providers in our network and that sort of thing. So I'm the person who just sort of oversees it all. But the real work is done by a lot of really fabulous people who are business and employees here.
I'd say then that you're sort of the head inspirationer, inspirer.
Yeah. Yeah, and somebody has to coordinate all this activity. There are so many moving parts to this, and so somebody has to oversee it.
Keep your eye on the whole thing. Keep your eye on and not get lost in the trees, but keep your eye on the forest. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of work to do.
It's funny, you don't sound a bit tired or a bit oppressed by that. You sound excited by that.
Well, you know, that's one of the wonderful things about living this way and eating this way is that, you know, again, I'm almost 60, and people in my age range, they're tired, they're thinking about retiring, how much time am I going to take off this year, and I'm thinking about how much I'm going to do this year, the places I'm going to go, the things I'm going to, you know, and I don't feel like stopping at all. I mean, I don't look like I'm 20 anymore, but I actually have more energy than I did when I was 20.
Well,
I feel like
getting
started.
I got to tell you, you had an incredible energy when we were doing Forks Over Knives together, and that's been like 5 years now. You sound even more energetic now than you did then.
I know. Well, I've got a lot to be excited about. I really do. And every day, you know, this field is so interesting. And it's interesting from so many perspectives. First of all, the people who you meet who are carving out their own niche in healthcare. Dr. Peter Bragan is a good example, a recent partner of ours. I mean, here's a psychiatrist who's been in practice for 50 years and never prescribed a drug, never institutionalized a patient, never had a completed suicide on his watch. And he's written 25 books about psychiatry and why we shouldn't drug people. And the guy is unbelievable. He is the person who is partly responsible for getting the FDA to release all the data that allowed the drugs to be approved, which they never should have been approved. I mean, he's just like a. If you think about all that he's done, you'd think he'd have to have 15 clones just to get it all done in the period of time that he did it. But when you're around people like that, it's hard not to be energized, you know. And I think collectively we energize each other because we really see their path to solving the problem.
Well, I also think that that's just a gift that you have and that you've always had, or at least since I've known you. And I got to say, too, that I'm glad that, you know, in some small way, even that Forks Over Knives help, you get your message through. So, I mean,
it was a big way. Let's face it, that movie was a game changer in so many ways. I mean, it was for all of us personally, and it was for the movement. And I don't think a day goes by here that somebody doesn't call. And either they call because of Forks Over Knives, or certainly it was part of, I saw the movie. And this funny thing that just happened today that I'll relate to, I was at the coffee shop, and the topic of Forks Over Knives came up because, you know, I'm in there all the time and people know about my involvement. And this this gal said, Forks Over Knives, what's that? And everybody looked at her like, you haven't seen Forks Over Knives? Like, oh, my gosh. You know, it's sort of, where have you been? I mean, have you been paying attention? And I thought, isn't that cool, though, that people feel that way, that, wow, everybody should see this. And if you haven't, where have you been? You know, so that means this really made a difference.
Well, that makes me feel great, and I'm certainly happy to have been a part of it. But, you know, I mean, I had a lot of help from a lot of different people, Brian and you and everybody else who appeared in the movie, and not to mention a certain guy named Dr. T. Colin Campbell and Dr. Esselstyn.
Yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, well, all of those people are, and I think Forks Over Knives was an example of what happens when some like-minded people get together and focus their attention in the right way. But have you talked to Dr. Campbell lately? He's 80, and he doesn't sound like he's slowing down at all.
No, not a bit. No, I see
him
fairly often. Yeah.
I called him to ask him to speak at our 20th anniversary conference. I think it's only fitting that he be here. And he was going to Romania, and he was going to be there for a while. Then he was doing a TED Talk about something, and then he was going to Brussels. And, you know, so it's always like, you know, let me get out my calendar and see, okay, that date's available. you know,
I know, he's like booked 7 months in advance.
I know. Slowing down.
None. He had this recently. I think you just referred to it in passing. He had some sort of a presentation in Brussels to the EU. You know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the message is getting around, which is great, and he is a fantastic man. I'm just really proud to know him. That's for sure.
Yeah,
so
we're all lucky people. You know, when you think about it, we've had the opportunity to spend time with Colin Campbell and Caldwell Eccleston and some of these people. Lots of people know who they are. Very few people really have had an opportunity to get to know them personally.
They're
and
such
I think
great
we're
guys.
Yeah.
They're such they're incredible people. I mean, they're fun to be around. They're talkative. I mean, and they're interesting to talk to. They're just and they're infectious too. They're just their enthusiasm and so forth. You can't not pick up on it.
Well, after it's you just, spend time with him, you sort. I remember the last time I spent time with Ann and S, another physician friend of mine, spent the night at their house, and then we went to S's program at Cleveland Clinic, and we got in the car after spending a couple days with them, and I thought I got to get busy. I mean, it's time for me to step up the game. I mean,
yeah.
You know, because Anne's writing a cookbook and making dinner for us, and some other people are coming over, and then her daughter and kids come over, and
yeah.
Like, oh, we have plenty of food for everybody, and then, you know, get up really early in the morning and drive to the clinic, and he's
yeah.
teaching this thing, and she's off making food for 57 people. And,
oh,
you know, so you watch
Pam.
This all go on, and you think, I got to get myself in gear here.
Yeah, Pam, you're such a slacker.
I know. Really need to up the productivity.
Really. So what are some of the most notable accomplishments of the Wellness Forum Health?
Well, I think the one of my favorite things to talk about is, and I've been talking about this in a lot of my presentations lately, because I think it's an important thing for all of us, and that is that we figured out a way to help people with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And this
mm-hmm.
is a long story that I'll summarize, but it goes to a lot of points. You hear people say all the time, we need more research. And there's almost this idea that before we can help more people with more conditions, we've got to wait for a Dr. Esselstyn of autoimmune diseases and a Dr. Esselstyn
right.
of Crohn's and colitis. And those will be wonderful things when they happen, and I certainly don't want anybody to think that I don't think we need more research. We do. But we have so much research already that we can draw from. So to
yeah.
make a very long story real short, about 16, 17 years ago, a friend of mine came to me, and she had Crohn's disease. She'd been sick for 20 years, and it was
yeah.
starting to affect her life in some profound ways. She'd been hospitalized every year for a while.
I remember this.
I started doing some research. I talked about this in my book, and you know, we started doing some research, and we found that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, I'm not exaggerating, of studies showing that diet has a profound effect on Crohn's and colitis. And so we started experimenting with some dietary protocols that would help make it better. And we got her into remission within a few weeks. She had a great gastroenterologist who went along with this. And she's still in remission today. She's our longest remission.
Oh, that's amazing.
Years. And we've now done this with hundreds of people. And so the reason I share this story is that we need more research, no question about it. But if we just start reading medical journals and looking for
yep.
information, it's there. You got to connect the dots. I mean, isn't it great that Dr. Esselstyn has put it all together? Here's 30
yeah.
years of data. I love that. But we don't have to have that to move forward and help people. And you can do the same thing with asthma, and you can do the same thing with lupus and so many of these other conditions.
It's,
we really have the information.
Yeah, and all these autoimmune diseases, like,
yes.
I mean, rheumatoid arthritis.
Yes.
Too, isn't that correct? I mean,
yes. Huge dietary connection.
I got to say that the Crohn's disease thing strikes close to home for me because my dad had it and he suffered terribly from it
yeah.
for years, and it's so I know how debilitating it can be.
Yeah, so that's been a big thing, and we love helping those people. Unfortunately, we've had the opportunity to help a lot of them, including some little children. For the first time, I had a kid last year who was born with Crohn's disease, interestingly
You're
enough.
You're kidding.
No.
And
at
I didn't
the age
know you
of
could
four,
be
had had no solid food her entire life on the planet.
Oh, my God.
And she has been in remission for several months now. She her SED rate's normal. I mean, she has no signs of the disease at this point in time. Now, she's got to stay on the straight and narrow diet-wise. She's had a couple
mm-hmm.
of times where she experimented to find out that she really can't eat some of those things that she used to
mm-hmm.
think she wanted. But I think that's been, I mean, we feel great about that. It's a big contribution we think we've made. We have now manuals and instructions and, you know, letters to give to the gastroenterologist. It's a very organized program here, and I'm real proud of that. I think that this new thing that we're starting our school, I think that's a big thing. Training for health professionals is abysmal. I know, because
my
own training wasn't what I wanted. So I think starting our school and building a good reputation with scientifically rigorous programs to reorient already trained health professionals who want to do the right thing and help those starting out to get the right type of training, I really am proud of that. You know, I look at the accomplishments of some of these people. I mean, think about Dell, who nobody knew about. He was sort of a hidden treasure, and now he's a New York Times best-selling author.
I know.
So, you know,
I know.
Opportunities we've created for people here. I could go on and on, but it's just, it's every day something wonderful happens here. My dad works here now. He's 85.
Really?
And he's the company proofreader. He comes in because, you know, I'm notorious for my typographical errors, which my father now catches. So anybody listening to this, if you've noticed that the newsletters and the written material doesn't have so many typos, we can thank Dad for that. Drug-free at the age of 85, working at Wellness Farm Health 3 days a week. So he's a testimony to this.
I love it. Moving on slightly, tell us about your work with PCRM.
Oh, love PCRM, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And there are so many things to love about PCRM. I'll tell Neil Barnard, he was in Forks Over Knives. He's another one.
Yeah.
You think he's probably got six clones somewhere. You can't believe one person gets this done, right?
Yeah, I know. Incredible.
Yeah, but I'll tell you the big things that PCRM has done. I think the first thing is this elimination of the use of animals in medical training in all but one medical school. It's a barbaric practice, but it actually is terrible training on top of everything else. Any medical doctor will tell you this, even very traditional docs. I recently had the privilege of being the inaugural speaker at the Barnard Medical Center. They opened a clinic in Washington, D.C., so if you live in Washington, D.C., you know how people are always asking, gosh, I wish I could find a doctor that understands this. This is a whole clinic full of doctors and dietitians who understand this. And I spent the day with them and got to meet the staff, and I had dinner with the medical director, who's awesome. And I will tell you, if I had a health issue, I'd get on a plane and go there. These are fabulous well-trained health professionals who practice in the way that we've been talking about for the last little bit here. So that's a huge accomplishment. And I think what they'd like to do is open more of these in other cities. And then when we talk about we need more research, Neil Barnard has been responsible, he and his colleagues, of adding to the body of research. They're doing a lot now with diet and pain, diabetes, that sort of thing. So they do great work. I'm happy to be associated with them and be a major contributor and to help them in any way I possibly can.
Oh, that's great, and good for you on that. They are a really important organization, I think, and Neil Barnard is one of those really special people in the world.
Well, have you ever noticed that everybody who works there is happy, fit, trim? I mean, they really are. I've never met an unpleasant person in those two floors full of people They're always terrific.
Grumpy not allowed on the premises.
Think not. Well, I've never seen Neil grumpy, so it must be one of those things that starts at the top.
Okay, moving on. Tell us about the Sacramento Food Bank Project. This is something I haven't heard of.
This is an exciting thing. I'll tell you, sometimes the things you hear about this diet change, it's like nails on the chalkboard. And I'm sure you've heard this before. It's hard to do. It's so hard, right? And then you did it.
Big change.
It wasn't that hard, right? And then, it's so expensive. Nobody can afford to do it. And, of course, you know what your grocery bill is. I know what my grocery bill is. And then you hear these derogatory comments, and this really bothers me. Oh, people don't care about their health. And, you know, particularly people who are economically disadvantaged, they just want to eat potato chips. And so this was a project that I had some participation in. The real hard work was done by Earth Save and John McDougall and a lot of people who organized this, and Whole Foods really contributed a lot. But the idea was to take people who were patrons of the Sacramento Food Bank, offer them an opportunity, it was their choice to make, to participate in a program where they would agree to come to training sessions where they would learn how to cook and learn about health and learn how to shop differently, feed their kids differently. They would have biometric screening done with the idea of health improvement, withdraw them from as many meds as possible, lose weight, et cetera. And we were able to show that, first of all, it wasn't hard to do, that they could do it within the limits of their economic circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the things I have students in a class I teach here do is to develop meal plans for people who are using SNAP and WIC money. And the diet looks about like what you and I eat every day. When you're eating potatoes and rice and beans, it's not expensive. Most important is that just as we see in middle-class populations, the people who were patrons of the Sacramento Food Bank lost weight, their blood pressure went down, their cholesterol dropped, they got off their meds, I think there was one dropout, everybody else finished the program. And we prove that people want to do it, they can do it, it's economically feasible. I really say that I had this epiphany when I was out there, because I was one of the instructors for the program, and that is that the one thing, or there are probably a few, but one big thing that unifies the entire country is this food and health issue. Because while that was going on, Bill Clinton was having his epiphany, laying in the hospital bed after the angioplasty, reading Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease and China Study, and he changed his diet. And I was out in Sacramento. I was going for an early morning run before it was time for me to teach. And I was thinking, you know, here I am with people who have nothing, and they want to do better for themselves. Their doctors haven't told them about this, but they want to eat better and improve their health. And Bill Clinton, one of the most important persons in the world, is sitting in New York having the same thing going on. The most, the least of us and the most advantageous of us are suffering.
It really does show you about the parallels in people's lives. Yeah, and those things that unite us. Everybody wants to be healthy. Everybody wants to feel good. And they get up and have, you know, be productive during the day and not feel like, you know, warmed over death.
And people don't want to be sick, you know.
No.
I love David Barker's quote. I close a lot of my presentations with this. You know, patients are really grateful for all of the drugs and procedures we've developed, but what they really want is not to be patients at all, and in this we have failed them. And so what people want is health. I mean, I always, just tongue-in-cheek, I'll ask people, how many of you grew up and said, you know what, when I grow up, here's what is on my list of things to do. I want to have great insurance so that I can be sick and go to lots of doctors and take lots of drugs and spend time in the hospital, and my insurance will pay for it. I mean, did anybody actually intend to end up there? Nobody. And then once you're there, John McDougall calls it the medical mill. It's so hard to get yourself out of it.
It's true. Well, you know, projects like that. So what was the wind-up with that? It was just a test project, or is there going to be any follow-up on that, the Sacramento Food Bank thing?
I don't know if the group went on to do other projects. We do have a 501c3 here, and we do some similar work in churches and populations around Franklin County in similar circumstances where they clearly can't afford services from Wellness Farm Health, so we just donate. And we see the same thing. You know, people may be economically disadvantaged, but it doesn't make them not interested in their health. And as for not knowing how to shop and buy healthy food, my gosh, we have millionaires in here who don't know how to shop and buy healthy food.
Yeah.
So that's not limited to a certain stratus, you know, certain part of the population.
So tell us something about your book, Food Over Medicine.
Well, it's a conversation. I don't know if you've read it, but it's a conversation, okay? And it was not my idea, by the way. I met Glenn Mercer at a it was a party in California, actually, to celebrate the Sacramento Food Bank results and to raise money to do more of that kind of work. And Glenn said to me, I'll never forget this, he said, you know, I'd like to write a book with you because I like your ideas. But he said, I think if we did it as a conversation, people would, we could cover more material and make it interesting. So it was his idea to do that, and so that's where the interview concept came from. And he's a marvelous writer, much better writer than I am. So my ideas and his writing style, and he really made that book a great book. But we cover a lot of ground. It isn't just about diet. It's about diagnostic testing and treatment and this whole idea of looking at healthcare through a different lens where it's not so reactive all the time.
Right. It's you got to get in beforehand. It's about prevention and about getting at the underlying reasons for things rather than just being reactive and treating symptoms.
Exactly. Exactly.
Are you working on or planning any future books right now?
Yeah, I got the contract to write the book on based on the new film Food Choices. And so that film comes out in September, and I think the book will be out shortly after that. And nothing after that. That's about as far ahead as I can think of all the other things I have on my plate. Lots of building here to do, and working on our conference. It's the 20th anniversary this year, so we're going to do it.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. How are you going to wedge in writing a book?
Because I don't sleep much. You remember from the Forks Over Knives days.
Yeah,
I wasn't a big sleeper then. I'm still not a big sleeper.
No.
I still sneak up to my house in Port Clinton, and that's where I can work 20 hours at a time without interruption.
20 hours, and that's fun. That's a normal day.
Yeah, for me it is. But I don't mind. You know, I'll never forget one day. I was supposed to go to a 4th of July party. I just thought about this because it's 4th of July weekend coming up. And I sat down to read the guy, who is Peter Gerchke, who is the co-founder of Cochrane, wrote a book called Mammography, Truth, Lies, and Controversy. It's a medical textbook. And so I sat down and started reading it. This was about 5 years ago on the 4th of July. I was supposed to go to a party at like 6 o'clock. And the next thing I knew, it was 10 o'clock at night. I'm still sitting in my house in Port Clinton reading Mammography, Truth, Lies, and Controversy. I thought to myself, I'm a science nerd because I sat here and read a book for 12 hours and missed the party.
It sounds like a real page-turner, though.
Yeah, that along with the New England Journal of Medicine and cancer is a metabolic disease. That's what I like to spend my time on.
It's good that you do, because otherwise you wouldn't have gotten where you've gotten, you know.
I think to be effective in this field, I tell you, we have interns here all the time now, and I that's a part of my life I really enjoy, by the way. We just had one from Berlin, a fabulous intern from Berlin. We have a medical student now here from Iowa. And one of the things that I really try to instill in these young people who spend time with us is developing what I call the curiosity gene.
Mm-hmm.
And they all, when they get here, and I tell them before they come, this is that you're going to spend a lot of time in front of a computer tracking down stuff so that we can create more material. And when they start out, they're a little worried, never did this kind of stuff before. And then the curiosity gene starts setting in. It's like, wow, look at all the stuff there is to find out. And so I co-authored with my my German intern 4 or 5 really lengthy articles. And my medical student right now is collaborating with me on some things. It's just so much fun to see that come to life. And we need more of that type of culture in medical school, dietetic school, nursing school. And it's not really cultivated the way it should be.
Mm-hmm. So what are your hopes and goals for the future of Wellness Forum Health?
Well, we think we can be a player in upsetting healthcare. And my big plan, my big hairy audacious goal, if you're familiar with the book Built to Last, is we want to siphon off about 10% of the healthcare market here. And we think we can do it by building the better mousetrap. We have a better mousetrap. We're just still building infrastructure to make it more solid. But we think we can siphon off a significant amount of revenue from the healthcare system because it's a better approach to healthcare. And then if we do that, when we do it is maybe the better way to say it, we'll be in a position economically to start doing some things where we can make big differences fast. One thing that I've looked at is, you know, if you look around at food banks, back to talking about the Sacramento Food Bank, if you look at what most people have to choose from, it's kind of abysmal.
And it is.
If you have a lot of money, you can just say, look, starting tomorrow, we're delivering produce to food banks. We, you know, that's the kind of thing I'd like to be able to do. So I have some lofty aspirations from the standpoint of building this company, but I have some really interesting things I'd like to do with all that money when it comes my way. So
good for you.
That's my plan. That's my plan, Lee. We're going to build we are building an alternative universe for healthcare. And every day we get more providers to join us, and every day more consumers come over here and say, I've had it with that over there. I don't want to be in the medical mill, you know. I want to make better decisions about healthcare, and I'm not going to do it with people who only tell me one side of the story and have
That's
a vested
great.
Interest in promoting drugs and surgery.
It's so great to hear, and I'm so glad that you're in the middle of it, and, you know, this is just terrific news. How far has the idea of plant-based nutrition come during your career, would you say?
Oh, huge. I remember when I used to go into restaurants and say I'm a vegetarian, they'd say, you're a veterinarian? I go, no. No, I'm a vegetarian. They could look at me like, really? And it was hard. This was hard 25 years ago. It was very hard to find restaurants that could cook this food. I remember going to, there's a Kroger store a mile from my house. Mm-hmm. And 20 years ago, you go to that Kroger store, and they had this little, maybe 3-foot-wide section, and it said above there, health food. And then you go
right.
on the rest of the store and go, well, what
yeah.
is the rest of this, right?
Yeah.
Today, you go to that, I go to that Kroger store. I'm in there every day. Between there and Wellness Farm Foods, I never, like, make a list and go buy a whole bunch of stuff because I can go there every day. They have everything you and I could think of to want. The produce section is amazing. They have a whole aisle of plant milk and, you know, vegan soups and fat-free salad dressings and, you know, so it's mainstream. And I think we had a discussion at lunch that was kind of interesting. It bears on this subject about vegan restaurants. And one of our staff members had taken a trip someplace and said, oh, I was kind of surprised not to see many vegan restaurants. And I said, well, you know, I think that the idea of a vegan restaurant is going to start to wane a little bit. And here's
yeah.
why. Because you can't be a good restaurant and not cater to people who eat like you and I do. And
yeah.
so in walking distance of my house in Port Clinton is a restaurant that is a carnivore's dream. They have everything on there that is horrible for you and I to eat. But every day there is a vegan entree on the menu, on the specials menu.
Wow.
And it's
mm-hmm.
fabulous because these people really know how to prepare food. This chef is amazing. Well, I don't want to eat rabbit and quail and all that, but all the talent that this guy knows how to put into rabbit and quail, he knows how to put into barley and vegetables with a balsamic glaze and, you know, steamed asparagus and pasta and vegetable dishes. So you can eat well in almost any restaurant. In fact, I can't remember the last time I went into a restaurant and could not find something that was great to eat, not just passable, but fine for me to eat, you know?
That's great news. Yeah,
so
that
I think it's
really
a whole
lot,
better.
That's does say a whole lot. It's an amazing transformation.
Yeah, and
so
I think it
your...
will continue to get that way because
let's face it,
the demand is there. This wasn't done out of some benevolence like, you know, Kroger
yeah.
doesn't say, let's do something nice for the people in Franklin
yeah.
County. If people didn't want to buy that stuff, it wouldn't be in the
yeah.
store. So there's demand now, and that's a wonderful thing, and that's only going to increase.
And that was my next question. What are your hopes for the future of plant-based nutrition in America?
I think it's going to become the norm. Already, this is not such a strange thing. No, nobody looks at you. Like when you walk into a restaurant and say, I've been in restaurants where, you know, I'd never been there before, menu's not
mm-hmm.
particularly veg-friendly, and you say to the waiter, look, I don't need any animal foods or dairy or anything, so can you go back and talk to the chef and, you know, see what he can do? I've never had anybody say anything other than, yeah, here's the chef. This happened when my book club met at a restaurant that just really didn't have anything on the menu. Chef came out.
Mm-hmm.
He said, do you like rice noodles? I said, yeah. He goes, any vegetables you don't like? I said, no. He says, okay, well, how about if I make you a stir fry with, you know, vegetables and rice noodles and, you know, top it off with a little tofu? I said, you have tofu back there? He goes, yeah, people ask for that. I said, oh, great. You know, I'm not the only one anymore, right?
What a transformation. Now it's like, yeah, the country's catching up to you, Pam.
Yeah, well, we did it before it was fashionable. Well, I did
yeah.
it 25 years ago. Can you imagine being John McDougal and doing this 50 years ago?
Oh, well, that... Yeah,
they must have thought he
that,
really was a freak, right?
Yeah, see, that's why I admire those guys so much, you know, McDougal and Esselstyn and Campbell, you know, they're like the pioneers. I think those are the guys, you know, along with maybe a couple of others, Ornish and maybe a few others, that they're up on the Mount Rushmore, I think, of this movement. I mean, McDougal, they were all out by themselves too. I mean, they all came to this sort of discovery separately, but at around the same time, well before they knew each other.
And there was no internet to connect people then.
No.
Yeah. That's been a big thing because think about the impact of forks over knives had it happened in 1985 instead of 5 years ago, because with the internet, everything spreads so fast.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Good news and bad news. I mean, ridiculousness spreads fast,
yeah,
too, and we have to deal with that. But good ideas spread fast. People find each other, and it accelerates everything. It's an exciting time to be doing this. I feel that's another one of those things where I feel very, very fortunate to have come along at this time when a whole lot of people who had it a whole lot tougher than me really paved the way.
So, and this is kind of how I wrap up my interviews with everybody. Do you think we've reached the tipping point in America regarding the benefits of plant-based nutrition?
Yeah, I think we have actually worldwide, and I'll tell you why I say that. This is important from a lot of different standpoints. One is obviously personal health, another is economics. Mm-hmm. But now that this carnivorous way of eating has become so prevalent in so many places, you've got organizations like the United Nations and the World Health Organization saying this way of eating that has become so common is completely unsustainable. Like, we're not going to
exactly
be able to live on this planet if we keep doing
mm-hmm.
it. And to some extent, this circles back to something we talked about earlier. There are a lot of people who maybe don't understand plant-based nutrition and the reason they should eat this way instead of the way they eat. But what they do understand is environmental concerns. What they do understand is economic concerns and that sort of thing. So I think we reach a lot of people who were formerly unreachable because of this type of interest. So I think we are reaching that tipping point, and I think we'll continue to see all of this accelerate.
Well, I hope you're right. I think you are. But I just hope you're right. And I got to say, it's because of people like you that tipping point is either here or is going to be reached, and we're going to be tipped over and never going back. And I've got to just commend you on your energy and your efforts and your passion and your enthusiasm and your knowledge and everything else. I mean,
well, I really
admire you.
Thank you. It's been a fun ride. I just can't imagine doing anything else. Can't imagine ever wanting to stop this. And I feel really lucky that with absolutely, no planning at all to end up in this business. Some people know what they want to do when they're 8. I had no clue when I was 18. So I had to wander around for 20 years until I happened on something that really got me excited. And some people wander around their whole life and don't get a chance like this. So I'm a lucky girl.
I gotta tell you, I'm really lucky too. I mean, I did like military documentaries my whole life, my whole career for the History Channel. And then I get a call out of the blue to do something about, the benefits of a vegetarian diet. And I was rolling my eyes thinking, I can't think of anything more boring than that.
And then here you are.
Yeah, and here I am. But then I read, the China study in prevent and reverse heart disease, and I went, wow, there really is a big story here, and it's an exciting story. So I'm so great. I mean, talk about tripping and falling into something. I tripped and fell into something, and it was only 5 years ago. So
well, and maybe at some point in time the two will merge. There will be some huge plant-based mob that, in some military fashion, takes over Congress and says enough already, and you'll get to make a documentary about that.
And everything will come together for me. That will then I will really have arrived. Well, Pam, it was great talking to you, as always, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good luck in the future.
Thanks.